dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney. I'm going to be your guide for the war of ideas. It's my privilege to be able to do it with Congressman Pete Hoekstra, the current ranking member, previously the chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Congressman Hoekstra will be talking with us about a number of things, including the Obama administration's approach to fighting the war we're facing at the moment. I call it the war for the free world. The terrorist trials, the screening of passengers in our airports, his recently completed tour of overseas posts of our CIA operatives, and much, much more. All of that coming up in segment one. Segment two and three, we have an extended visit with Karen Lugo, a terrific constitutional scholar and professor who is at the point of the spear in fighting against the encroachment of Sharia in America. We'll be talking with Karen about both what's at stake and how we can win that particular fight. And then finally, segment four, Norman Bailey, formerly a right-hand man to President Ronald Reagan, is going to talk to us about what's happening south of our border, the threat emerging specifically from Venezuela, Hugo Chavez's dictatorship, and his friends, the new axis of evil around the world. All of that is a very full plate, but we're delighted to start with Congressman Pete Hoekstra right out of the box. Congressman, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Hey, great. Always good to be with you. Thanks.
We have not spoken since this remarkable election, I think. I congratulate you, your team, your party. I know you're not going to be there to enjoy the return to the majority, but I'm sure that you appreciate that this really represents such a signal opportunity to redirect some of the things, and I'd like to visit with you about several that I hope will be the subject of some concerted attention by your successors and colleagues. Let's start with the trial of Ahmed Ghalani, the now convicted conspirator, but a man who walked on hundreds of counts of murder in connection with attacks on American embassies in Africa. What did you make of it? What should we be doing to make sure it doesn't happen again?
Well, I think, you know, let's look at this as a global approach to national security by the Obama administration. You know, early on, almost immediately on day one and through the campaign, this president made it clear that he was going to treat the threat from terrorism as a legal threat, as a criminal threat. And that is how we got to the point where rather than trying Ghalani in a military tribunal for the murder of 224 people in Africa in 1998, Eric Holder and this administration made the fateful decision that said, we're going to try him in civilian courts. And as we prove that we can successfully prosecute a terrorist like this, it kind of paves the way then for us to move Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others into the criminal court system, move them into New York, and have them tried for their activities in connection with 9/11. What we've recently found out is that lawfare doesn't work. We are involved in a war. We're not engaged in criminal activities.
Lawfare, meaning using legal instruments against our enemies, don't work to counter active terrorist entities. But unfortunately, I'm afraid you would agree, lawfare by them has proven to be altogether too successful. And maybe this is an example of it with Ahmed Ghalani. Do you see in the aftermath of the outcome of this trial, dismal as it was, any likelihood that the administration will press ahead with its effort to bring KSM into the civilian court system? Congressman Hoekstra?
Yeah, I mean, I think all the indications, Frank, have been, you know, the comments by the administration. is that they remain committed to trying to use civilian trials rather than indefinite detention or military tribunals as the appropriate process. They seem to be firmly rooted into going into the courts. It's a huge mistake. I don't think they've learned anything from what happened with the trial of Gilani, and I think that the only way we're going to be able to stop them is for the Republicans in the House is to start putting in limitations on spending in appropriations bills, saying no dollars may be used to transfer these terrorists into the United States. No money may be expended by the Department of Justice to try these guys in civilian courts.
It's a blunt instrument, but sometimes it is the most effective and in others the only way to stop an administration that is hell-bent for folly from doing its will. Congressman Hoekstra, can I ask you to address yourself to what is becoming an increasingly turbulent issue, particularly in this Thanksgiving holiday period, namely the introduction by the Transportation Security Administration of both new body scanning devices, and where those aren't used at the whim of the passenger or for whatever other reason, pat-downs. Are we taking steps that, in your estimation, are both needed and appropriate given the nature of the danger we're facing? And if not, what should we be doing instead?
Well, no, I think clearly the threat is out there. You know, we've seen that recently with the attempted bombings of these cargo planes. The threat is real. Al-Qaeda, specifically Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula, wants to attack the United States, they're magazine Inspire recently came out with a special edition where it's clear if you read these articles and the commentary in there, they for whatever reason continue to be fixated on airplanes, air traffic and those types of things as their preferred target. So the threat, I believe, is very, very real, both from overseas and from domestic homegrown terrorism. Clearly also the TSA, if you're going to do this stuff, try this stuff out on a more limited basis, see what public reaction is, but it appears what they've done is they embark on strategies, they go nationwide with them, and then they find out, well, these things aren't being accepted by the public. The public is openly hostile to these types of things. And try to come up with a system that is effective and acceptable. I think on this thing, it's clearly the system is not acceptable to the public, and there are questions about effectiveness. But it's government jumping, it's shoot, ready, aim.
Yeah.
they've done this all backwards.
Yeah. Well, and again, this is an area where I anticipate we're going to see corrective action taken by the Congress. I just hope that in the process we're not going to make ourselves considerably more vulnerable to the threat. And that really argues for, as you've said all along, Congressman Pete Hoekstra, a much more thoughtful and clear-eyed approach to understanding the nature of the enemy and counteracting them. In the minute or so we have left with you, Congressman, and I'm sorry it's so short, but give us a quick update, if you would, on the WikiLeaks problem.
Well, there continue to be suspicions that WikiLeaks actually has a lot more documents that they have not released that could be very, very damaging to the U.S. image, because, again, these are personal communications that no one ever expected to see in public, but they could end up there. There could also be other intelligence that would be very damaging to our efforts against radical jihadists. And so this all talks about, we've got all these other wars going on. We've got to be much better in cyberspace. There's so much in cyberspace that can happen, both to keep us safe, but also if we are vulnerable and let this information get out, it can be very damaging. It's amazing that this number of documents were able to be stolen off of a U.S. government website by some lowly technician, and it was never discovered.
Never discovered until too late. Congressman Pete Huxer, we're going to have to leave it at that for the moment. We're going to actually continue a conversation with you on Friday, and I hope all of you will join us for part two of our interview with Congressman Pete Hoekstra, the outgoing ranking member of the Intelligence Committee, one of the real leaders on national security in the 111th Congress and for many before that. Congressman Hoekstra, thank you as always for your service to our country and for joining us here at Secure Freedom Radio. And we'll be talking with you a bit further the day after Thanksgiving. In the meantime, happy Thanksgiving to you, sir, and God bless.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
Next up, we will be talking with Karen Lugo about Sharia and what we can do to stop it from coming here. Straight ahead.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Terrorist threats, global economic recession, monumental government spending, continued job losses, healthcare reform. Who can sort all of this out? Hudson Institute. Since its founding nearly 50 years ago, Hudson Institute continues to lead the pack in groundbreaking policy research. John McCain said Hudson continues to make the world less threatening to our security and more hospitable to our values. To read the latest commentary and research from Hudson's world-renowned policy experts, visit our website at www.hudson.org. You can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, keep up to date on our latest events, podcasts, and exclusive video features, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Visit www.hudson.org.
This is the greatest country in the world. Every day, people in America live in 100% freedom. Our military allows us to do that. It's comforting to know that when American lives are lost in defense of our freedom, an organization like TAPS is there to help the friends and families of those who have died while serving our country.
TAPS, the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors. Visit us online at TAPS.org or call 1-800-959-TAPS.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Karen Lugo, one of the free world's most important weapons in the arsenal of defending our freedoms, constitutional freedoms in particular, against the threat posed by enemies, foreign and domestic. And most especially, we're going to talk with Karen about that represented by the adherence to Sharia. Karen is the founder of the Libertas West Project in California. She is the co-director of the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence at the absolutely indispensable Claremont Institute. She is also, in her spare time, a visiting professor at Chapman University Law School. And she is one of the folks that we caught up with on the margins of the David Horowitz Freedom Center's Restoration Weekend in Palm Beach, Florida. And Karen, thank you so much for finding a few minutes to talk with us about some of the most important issues of our time.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here, and thank you for what you're doing in this field.
We are joined by a common sense that the Constitution of the United States is under assault, not simply from people who wish to introduce, transnational secular law, the versions that the UN promulgates, and the sort of socialist agenda of Barack Obama and so on, but that there is this other element to it that the enemy calls Sharia, that they seek to insinuate into this country and ultimately use to supplant our Constitution. You have been following these sorts of threats closely. What do you make of them? How serious would you say they are?
I think that the direct threat from Sharia to our Constitution, since there is a collision course, our individual liberties are at stake, women's rights are at stake, free speech more than anything has been, I believe, the first to go. So I think the threat from Sharia is more direct and more urgent and something that we must address, and I do think we have already lost many of the smaller skirmishes. I mean, people may not think they count, but when you add those up, they accrue to be already huge losses, and certainly in the minds of the Sharia advancing Muslims, these are major milestones.
Give us a sense of that, because I think you're absolutely right, needless to say, but can you provide some examples of ways in which free speech or other rights are being impinged upon, and particularly why, especially taken together, they do amount to a serious threat?
Just looking at the example of Pastor Jones and his stunt with burning the Quran, while that was, and everybody always, first starts with a disclaimer that that was a repugnant act, whatever. At this point, I am more furious with the fact that he was coerced to back down under the threat of radical Muslims will act up and will kill our troops. And, we will be putting someone in jeopardy. So what we did is send the message that if this threat appears, that we will, whatever it is, fill in the blank, if it's burning the Quran or whatever else now they choose to use that threat to stop, we have now conceded, abdicated, said all you have to do is threaten, and then all we have to do is kind of twist somebody's arm behind his back and say, hey, just like Molly Norris, when that fatwa comes out, we won't be there to protect you, and you're going to lose everything.
Let's talk about the Molly Norris case, because that really does seem to me, we spoke earlier with Pat Cadell about it as well, but it really does seem to me to be a sort of iconic example of the threat to freedom of speech and ultimately to our other freedoms as well. What's the backstory to that episode?
Well, I think first starting with the bottom line, that she went down or went ghost without a whimper. I mean, the American people did nothing.
But tell us who she was and what happened to her and why she went ghost.
She was a woman who initially, from what I understand, kind of flippantly said, let's just have an everybody draw Muhammad Day. And I think this came from...
Because these Sharia-adherent Muslims claim that
Danish,
that is offensive and
correct.
Therefore
the Danish
the
cartoons.
Pretext for violence and everything else.
Exactly. When the Danish cartoons had been such a big deal, and there had been the retributive acts over in Denmark, Ayan Hirsi Ali has come out several times, and we know her, the author of Infidel and the wonderful now Clarion Western thinker at AEI. She said, look, if you disperse the threat over thousands of people, they can't find one or two, and so it will be easier to act. So Molly Norris, I think in that spirit, said, hey, let's just everybody do it on one particular day, and it took off. I mean, all she had to do was speak that. I had a Facebook page where some of these cartoons went through my page. Mine was shut down for half a day. It went dark, ghost, black.
Wow.
But it definitely became a way that so many people who have been very anxious to speak out on this said, hey, we want to participate. So then the FBI, after Al-Awlaki issued a fatwa on her, the FBI approached her and said, look, we take this seriously. We can't protect you. You lose your identity, your job, everything. Move and go dark underground.
Again, let's introduce the cast of characters again, because some folks probably have heard some of these names but may not be familiar with them. Anwar Al-Awlaki is a former imam in the Dar al-Hijra Mosque, about 20 minutes from our seat of government in Northern Virginia.
Falls Church, Virginia.
Who used that platform to proselytize, to entertain, to inspire, among others, the 9/11 hijackers.
Right.
Subsequently fled the United States. He's an American citizen, but nonetheless fled the United States. Now, we're believed, is residing in Yemen. From which he is issuing fatwas and launching terrorist attacks against this country. So he did this against Molly Norris. The FBI said, "You're on your own." Somebody described it to me as the witness protection program without the protection.
Right.
you're just supposed to go away. And this is really a clarion example of what can happen to any of us if we're not submitting. And that's the term that I really wanted to maybe tie this particular segment up with, is the practice you've been suggesting is afoot here, Karen Lugo, of the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence at the Claremont Institute, is really, especially taken cumulatively, an act that's seen by our enemies as submission. And what does that portend?
Well, look at the fact that right after 9/11, this certainly would not have gone down without note. Molly Norris's, forced disappearance. Also consider the media. Look at the McCarthy era. They rallied around their own. I mean, when it came to media this time, there was not a word. I mean, she was just left to hang on her own. Also, I would go back and add a real quick footnote. When it came to the Falls Church Virginia Mosque in Ahwatukee, as it was originally, that was being permitted, it was described as a cultural center, and that's something we need to watch, and I'm sure we'll discuss at another time, but that is
Let's talk about it right now, because the cultural center is what we are now told we must accommodate around the country. What is that about?
Well, of course, it's presented when the permitting process goes forward as a community outreach, and, now with the Ground Zero Mosque, we've heard about the swimming pools, So all of this becomes a very nice sounding sense of a community center. And of course, we know for Muslims, the mosque is the center of their lives and everything that they do. So there is a whole...
Not for all of them necessarily, but certainly for the Sharia adherent ones.
Yes.
Big time.
So there is a whole kind of a mystique and a regime that goes around that for the more adherent. But when it comes to the permitting process in America, we tend to have different rules for what is a religious use and what is a cultural community use. So there have been cases where there have been more parking permits issued, more, a different treatment of these mosques, and certainly better acceptance.
That's certainly true at Ground Zero.
Absolutely.
Let me just stitch together one point. Faisal Abdul Rauf, the imam of the Ground Zero Mosque, I learned just the other day, has published a book in which he talks about the cultural center and what it's supposed to be about that perfectly tracks with language in the so-called explanatory memorandum of the Muslim Brotherhood, the strategic plan for America, which also describes the importance of the cultural center as the leading edge of dawah, their proselytizing. But interestingly enough, Faisal Abdul Rauf seems to overlook that there's one phrase that's in the Muslim Brotherhood's strategic plan, namely that these centers are supposed to be used to train battalions, that he somehow left out of his book. We'll be talking about what this is all about, this stealth jihad, more with Karen Lugo of the Claremont Institute's Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence and Chapman University Law School and Libertas West Project, and much, much more, in particular, what we can and should be doing about it. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Can I have a price check on aisle... ma'am?
Yeah.
Don't look down, but there's a giant python wrapped around your leg.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's probably nothing.
Nothing? Shouldn't I don't know, like, call someone?
No, I don't have the time. I'm late as it is. If it keeps up, I'll have it looked at.
Are you sure? That's a pretty big snake.
No, I'm fine. Thank you, though. You're very sweet.
You wouldn't ignore this, so why ignore the signs of a stroke? If you or someone you know suddenly experiences numbness of the face, arm, or leg, or sudden trouble speaking, seeing, or walking, don't wait to get help. Call 911 right away, because time lost is brain lost. To find out more, visit www.strokeassociation.org or call 1-888-4-STROKE. This message brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks. Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
This morning, a woman reached out. A man stepped up. A family drove their elderly neighbor to the doctor. Someone took 2 hours of their morning to help someone else find affordable childcare near work. Somebody sat down with 16-year-old Stephen and taught him better note-taking skills and study habits, and suddenly, toughing it out till graduation seemed to Stephen a pretty good idea. All this happened today. It'll happen tomorrow. It's happening here, there, right down the street. People are living united. We're not just wearing the shirt, we're living it. We're realizing that the way we live our lives can impact the way others live theirs, their education, their income, even their health. So do something, any little something, as long as it's something. Give, advocate, volunteer. Live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Terrorist threats. Global economic recession, monumental government spending, continued job losses, healthcare reform. Who can sort all of this out? Hudson Institute. Since its founding nearly 50 years ago, Hudson Institute continues to lead the pack in groundbreaking policy research. John McCain said Hudson continues to make the world less threatening to our security and more hospitable to our values. To read the latest commentary and research from Hudson's world-renowned policy experts, visit our website at www.hudson.org. You can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, keep up to date on our latest events, podcasts, and exclusive video features, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Visit www.hudson.org.
Radio that improves your chances for survival in a dangerous world. Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. Make Facebook your source for essential national security analysis. Search for Frank Gaffney and add him to your friends list.
Welcome back. I'm delighted to say we are still accompanied by Karen Lugo. She is a woman of many parts and a formidable advocate for the cause of freedom. In such vantage points as Libertas West Project. She also is the co-director of the Claremont Institute's Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, and she teaches law, which is a very important thing, particularly in this space, Karen Lugo, at Chapman University Law School. Thank you for staying with us here at Secure Freedom Radio for another segment in which we're going to talk about something that we don't often enough do, in a very practical, very even, hopefully instructive way, think through what we can do. Once we understand that this jihadism that we talk about in Sharia, the threat to America, the Team B2 report, and in the work that you have been doing, once we get what these characters are up to as they try to insinuate this really, I think, seditious program into our country to initially compete with and ultimately supplant the Constitution of the United States, let's think about what we as individuals in some cases and as communities can do to stop them from taking us down.
Sure. I think initially, looking right back at the beginning of the process, the permitting process in our communities is an area in which many people are beginning to get involved.
Permitting things like these cultural centers, mosques,
right,
and the like.
Exactly. And what that all means. And many not understanding that so much of this process is up on city websites. So it is easy to obtain the information, which spells out what kind of a permit they must apply for, what processes they must pass, and what the city council should be considering. And soon some of us will be providing additional information under the Constitution, which can be considered. We know that we have freedom of worship in this country. We know we have the Establishment Clause. Most states have non-preferential provisions within their constitutions, and those are being...
Decrypt this for the layperson. You're talking about the constitutional separation of church and state, and basically non-preferential means that all religions are supposed to be treated equally, but
right,
not be
and I
of
will,
or part of or sponsored by the government.
Right, and I will back up to say that I do not believe, and historically it is not correct, that there was a separation of church and state. That's a whole different discussion. But, of course, most of us know that came from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote. But there is, under the First Amendment, there is the Establishment Clause, which says the federal government may not establish a state religion. And certainly there are some moving even within the Muslim community, what I call reform-minded Muslims, that are trying to establish separation of mosque and state. And that is what we're working toward, is equal treatment for mosques and churches. And right now we are seeing many examples of mosques getting preferential treatment, meaning they're asking for, right now some of this is in process, but minarets that are taller than steeples in a community. I know of a situation where a community is sharing a public park for overflow parking space, which would not be allowed for a church. When it comes to praying on sidewalks or in streets, we've seen what's happened in Paris and other parts of France. We don't, that's not allowed for
which
churches.
Is essentially taking over those
entirely
streets.
Now moving to new streets and now 750 no-go zones in all of France. I mean, it happens quickly. As one woman that I just talked to yesterday said about Dearborn, Michigan, it seemed like it happened overnight. But it's always a matter of small steps, and where we need to be stopping and controlling and monitoring is within the early steps of the permitting process for the mosque.
This is such a critical point, because it seems as though so many of these steps, particularly at the early stages, as you say, are, well, troubling perhaps, but relatively innocuous. And isn't it really about people just practicing their faith? And is it that big a deal that we make just, well, a minor accommodation? It's not that much skin off our nose. Especially against the backdrop that if we don't accommodate them, that at least there's some apprehension that maybe there will be some ugliness that goes with this. So you see cumulatively these things building, and as you say, I think it's so important to keep in mind the fact that if you want to know where this leads, look at Europe. We don't have to, conjure up an image. It's there now. 750 no-go zones is a prime example. Okay, so permitting processes, monitoring, and where appropriate, interposing objections to preferential treatment. What else can we be doing to stop the stealth jihad?
Thinking about the Tea Party movement and how the Tea Party movement has given courage to legislators, and in fact, worldwide, countries are looking at the Tea Party movement. We've heard, just this last few days in discussion how Israelis have taken courage from our Tea Party. Our people, as they go into city councils and begin to monitor, I do know from experience in litigating issues of land use, city councils are not that aware of the federal constitution or federal statute. So it is going to be an education for city councils at times for people to come in. But this show of support, and it's not that everyone should be speaking before a city council meeting, but a show of numbers as far as local community people supporting a separation of mosque and state and an understanding of what part of Islam Islam is Sharia and how to recognize when there is an advancement of Sharia and when it is the type of worship space that we must protect even for Muslims in this country under the First Amendment.
Yeah. Again, as we talked about at the David Horowitz Freedom Center event, Restoration Weekend, Karen Lugo, my most important takeaway from the Team B2 study was this insight that really Sharia, this political, military, intelligence, legal doctrine, is really about power. It's a totalitarian, as we said, seditious program, not about faith. It's got the patina of religiosity to it, to be sure. And for a lot of people, you know, that's all they mean when they talk about Sharia. But for those who are the problem here, those who are the mainstream of Islam and adhere to this program faithfully, it is about power. So to the extent that that insight can be communicated in these city council meetings, in state legislatures, in court cases and the like, presumably it gives us a latitude to defend our country against this operation, in fact, an obligation to defend our Constitution against this operation, rather than to allow them to use the Constitution essentially to shield them against our efforts. Let me ask you specifically one question that I very much worry about in terms of this business about separating mosque and state. Sharia-compliant finance is, I think, in some ways the most insidious of the stealth jihadi techniques. Have you been able to look at the case that has been brought against the federal government by our colleague David Yerushalmi in connection with the U.S. government's ownership of the largest purveyor of Sharia-compliant insurance products in the world, AIG? And does that strike you as the kind of place where we ought to be drawing the line and fighting these things in court or in legislatures or elsewhere?
I'm not as familiar with this Sharia finance, the specific case, as I am the general theory of this avenue of coming into a culture. And certainly, you know, whether it's money, family, treatment of women, community attitudes, there are many avenues through which they are coming into our communities. And I was recently asked to write a brief for the Consultata in France on how to ban the burqa. They were curious, and the request did not come from the judges themselves, but from some involved in the legal community. And it is a very challenging thing to do under our Constitution. And so all of these issues, and what you suggest as far as Sharia finance, all of these things provide some challenges for us. But I think while we have unique challenges, we have unique opportunities in the U.S. that other countries have not had due to our sense of freedom and assimilation and our own strong identity, which we must keep and must also require others to join rather than asking us to conform to their way of life. But in looking at this brief, I went back to the history, the Bernard Lewis, you know, analysis of what is political about Sharia Islam and what is worship about, you know, the Muslims. And in this case, I have to characterize those as reform-minded. Mm-hmm. For me, it's not a matter even of modernization. So in working through this, it is so important that we, in looking at initiatives like the Oklahoma law, that we are very careful to structure a very a carefully crafted statute so that we know that what we are doing is telling our governments that they are not able to consult, whether it's Sharia code or councils or jurists, but we do not want and are going to prohibit what we have control over is the jurisdiction, and so we're saying that our law cannot come from or arise from those bodies, the Sharia body of law. And so
was unfortunately not as carefully crafted in the Oklahoma case as it could have been. In Tennessee and Louisiana, we've had rather better laws adopted. An even better one, we think, is the model that has been proposed by the American Public Policy Alliance. And we commend that one in particular to those of you who are interested in following Karen Lugo's very important suggestions here about what we can do to stop the stealth jihadis and their efforts to destroy Western civilization, including here in the United States, from within.
Exactly.
With what they say is sabotage by our own miserable hands. This is right out of the Muslim Brotherhood playbook. Karen Lugo, thank you for the work that you're doing to counter this and to raise the alarm about it and to teach us what specifically, practically, we can do. Come back to us soon here at Secure
Thank
Freedom
you.
Radio. In the meantime,
I'd love to.
Next up, Norman Bailey, President Reagan's chief economist, tells us about the threats emerging south of the border in America's front yard. Straight ahead.
Miss a show? Find podcasts of Frank and the world's leading national security experts and policymakers at securefreedomradio.org.
This is Frank Gaffney. Are you tired of Congress rushing through far-reaching legislation without understanding the consequences or even reading the bill? It's given us a flawed health care plan, an ineffective stimulus package, runaway spending, and crippling debt. Now President Obama wants the Senate to treat our national security the same way by approving the new START treaty with Russia before anyone really understands its ominous implications. The treaty would leave us with fewer deployed nuclear weapons than the Russians and impede our missile defenses while doing nothing about growing nuclear threats from China, Iran, and North Korea. When it comes to keeping America safe, it can't be business as usual on Capitol Hill. Tell your senators that in an ever more dangerous world, we need a strong and reliable deterrent, not a bad treaty. Stop the START treaty now. Paid for by the Center for Security Policy, stopthestarttreaty.org.
I'll pick you up after school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted, and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit. Make a plan. Be informed. Today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
Fire took place 3 years ago. There was a lightning strike. The winds picked up and the fire just took off. You're in shock. You don't know what you're feeling. You have nothing. I lost my home and 40 years worth of art. I never thought that I would need help from the Red Cross. They gave me emotional support to get up in the morning. I'll never forget what the Red Cross did for me.
Contact your local Red Cross chapter or visit redcross.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're joined by a great hero of mine, a man who served with distinction in President Reagan's National Security Council, where he was the senior economist and director for international economic affairs on that hugely important fulcrum on which I think President Reagan really moved the world. It was the locus of the plan for taking down the Soviet Union, and Norm Bailey had a considerable role in all of that. And it's great to have you with us, sir. You are now an adjunct professor of economic statecraft at an institution I regard very highly, the Institute of World Politics, and you are also the president of the Institute for Global Economic Growth and vice chairman of the Americas Forum. So a man of many distinctions and considerable corporate memory. And Norm, I'd like to talk with you particularly today about what is afoot south of our border, most especially in and as a result of what is going on in Venezuela today. Give us a sense, if you would please, of the main actors in the Venezuelan drama and what it means for us.
Well, Frank, the main actor, of course, is the president of Venezuela himself, Hugo Chavez. a former army officer, a person who led a coup in 1992 against the Venezuelan government. It failed. He was imprisoned. He was then released. He then ran for president and won. And back in 1998, was inaugurated in early 1999, and has been president ever since. There have been several changes. The entire Constitution was thrown out, as well as the Congress, and replaced by a new Constitution, which he sponsored and then has violated wholesale since then. He has systematically taken control of all the instruments of state power, both civilian and military and police, and he has been engaged busily in socializing, or some would say communizing, the...
I would call it communizing.
Yes, the Venezuelan economy. Just in the last few months, hundreds of enterprises and farms have been expropriated. And I,
yeah, and how's that working out for him, Norm?
Well, it's working out fine for him because it consolidates his power. It's working out very badly for Venezuela because... once the these enterprises and farms are seized, they all of they almost overnight become non-productive. And one aspect of the Venezuelan government at this point is that it controls everything, as I mentioned. And the other aspect is it's enormously inefficient, so that that despite the relatively high price of oil. Despite the fact that Venezuela has received over the last 10 years more than $1 trillion in oil receipts, the country is essentially bankrupt. Oil proceeds are, oil production is declining, and the country is in consistently worse shape from the economic and financial standpoint.
Okay, well, so this...
of course, has been turned into a dictatorship.
Yeah, but Norman Bailey, this sounds as though a country that is, for all intents and purposes, at least a failed state from an economic point of view, would become less of a problem to its neighbors and to most especially us in the United States, and yet that doesn't seem to be the case. How is it that this individual Hugo Chavez, despite destroying his economy and presumably thereby killing the proverbial goose that laid the golden egg, especially the petrodollar egg, is nonetheless able to keep himself afloat and to engage in mischief both in the region and around the world?
Well, I mean, the one aspect of Chavez's government from the very beginning has been anti-Americanism. Another one is his consistent attempt to create an anti-U.S. coalition of countries and governments around Latin America. Much of the oil wealth of Venezuela was spent on trying to influence and buy elections around Latin America, some of which were successful, some... thank heaven we're not successful. He does have three very strong allies at this point in Latin America, Nicaragua, Ecuador, and Bolivia, and Argentina is sometimes put in that group, although it's not quite as much of a satellite as the others. In any case, it has been his anti-Americanism has displayed itself not only because by these means, but also by the support of terrorist and insurgent groups, such as the two insurgent groups in Colombia, as well as...
These are the narco-trafficking, terrorist sponsoring and opprobrious
right,
outfits.
And his encouragement of drug trafficking, the use of Venezuelan banking system by the Iranians, his encouragement of fundraising through drug trafficking and by other means by terrorist groups in the Middle East, such as Hamas and Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad, so that all of this are direct threats to the national security of the United States as well as to the other countries of the hemisphere.
Yeah, we're talking with Dr. Norman Bailey of multiple incarnations and capacities, including as serving as the president of the Institute for Global Economic Growth and vice chairman of the Americas Forum. But we particularly salute you, Norm, for your service to President Reagan many years ago. And I wanted just to pick up on this point about how this, for want of a better phrase, maybe axis of evil that Hugo Chavez is deeply involved in, ranging from Russia and China to Iran to Hamas to Hezbollah, as well as his sort of clients and proxies in the region, and of course the Fidel and Raul Castro team in Cuba. What is it that, when you say these relationships constitute a threat to the national security of the United States, do you worry about most?
Well, what I worry about most, quite frankly, in terms of a direct threat on a U.S. soil, is the fact that Venezuela is providing identity documents, passports, and other documents for Iranians, for members of Hamas and Hezbollah, and others being given Venezuelan identity documents, and then making it that much easier for them to infiltrate into the United States. That is what I fear the most in terms of a direct threat on the soil of the United States.
With all which you anticipate
are certainly also threats to the national security of the United States in the hemisphere.
And obviously one of the things that these terrorists could be doing if they're using these Venezuelan passports to come into the United States is to bring some pretty nasty stuff with them, including perhaps weapons of mass destruction. Norm, one other piece of this that I just want to touch on, we're going to have to wrap this very quickly, but Russia is offering a nuclear power capability to Venezuela. What might flow from that?
Well, probably not much of anything. I mean, first of all, promises are cheap. The Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians have offered all kinds of things all over Latin America, and only in some cases the Chinese have delivered. The Russians and the Iranians, by and large, have not delivered. And if, in fact, Venezuela gets a nuclear power plant out of it, it doesn't really make any difference. It's not a threat to us.
Norm, I'm going to have to interrupt you just to say goodbye because we're out of time. Let me just say, I hope you're right, nothing comes of it, and I hope most especially you're right that it doesn't serve as the cover for an Iranian-style nuclear weapons program, which has also been enabled by the Russians. But, Norm, I got to let you go. I'm so sorry, my friend. Thank you for joining us. It's great to have you with us, as always, and we look forward to talking with you further. That's it for today's installment of Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. Come back tomorrow, same time, same station. Till then, it's Frank F. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.